today, pretty much where we left off yesterday, do the same kind of thing, talk about some of the events in Bonhoeffer's life, and use some of the readings from his works as interpretive of his life and his thought. We'll start today with 1939, summer, when Bonhoeffer is trying to make some important decisions. He is feeling very restive because of events in Germany and events in his own life. He is seriously contemplating leaving Germany. There's some real disappointment in the Confessing Church for Bonhoeffer, which was for Bonhoeffer the only church. In fact, he wrote at one time that outside there's an old phrase that some of you may know, outside the church there is no salvation. Bonhoeffer wrote that in Germany, outside the Confessing Church, there is no salvation. That made all sorts of people very angry and stirred a large debate in public. Bonhoeffer was becoming very disappointed in the Confessing Church, and as I mentioned yesterday, in part because it seemed to him to be withdrawing and fighting for its own salvation rather than the salvation of others, and he had in mind particularly the Jews. In Letters and Papers from Prison, you have in the outline for a new book that he worked on in the last months of his life, the phrase, "The church is only the church when it is for others," which is a direct parallel of Bonhoeffer's understanding of Jesus. Jesus is the man for others. The church is only the church when it is for others. That remark is a remark casting itself back on a disappointment at this time in the late 30s of Bonhoeffer with the Confessing Church kind of working, not taking sufficient risks for the victims in Nazi Germany. So that is one factor in his decision now to leave Germany in the summer of 39. Another one, and probably more important, although it's hard to sort of put a quantity on these reasons and tally them up in that fashion, but Bonhoeffer is still in a sort of pacifist mood, and he's not at all sure that he can, well, let's put it this way, he's worried about the draft. He wants somehow to get out of conscription, which is a real threat. He says at one point in a letter to a friend, Bishop Bell, "The worst thing of all is the military oath. Even if I should become a chaplain," which is what he has in mind if he must do service at all, not a soldier, but a chaplain, "the military oath swore allegiance to directly to Hitler, not even simply to Germany." And so Bonhoeffer says, "I cannot in conscience take the military oath." So if there's a threat of the being conscripted and then doing service as a chaplain, he still would have to take that military oath. The penalty for not refusing to take the military oath was death. The penalty in Germany for conscientious objection was death. And one of Bonhoeffer's friends, a fellow named Hans Schur, refused to take insisted on being a conscientious objector and was hanged, and that was at this time, in 1938. All right, the military oath, the draft, disappointment with the Confessing Church, these reasons add up to when the opportunity comes, arranged by Reinhold Niebuhr and a friend of Bonhoeffer's at Union Seminary, and now an eminent American theologian, Paul Lehmann, make a place for Bonhoeffer by way of a kind of lecture circuit in the United States. And Bonhoeffer leaves Germany in 1939, not knowing if he's going to return, at least not until after the war. He's at Union Seminary in New York for only a matter of about 6 weeks, and it isn't long after he gets there that he becomes very restless, and he asks himself in his diary whether he is not abandoning the place where Jesus is. He says, "We can only be where he is for us." And for Bonhoeffer, where he is, where Jesus Christ is, for us, that is for himself, is in Germany. So he's offered a job, besides doing a sort of lecture tour circuit, he's offered a job working with German refugees and expatriates, sort of a combination of administrative and chaplaincy kind of work. A job, incidentally, that Paul Tillich, who came about the same time, earlier, I guess. Yeah, it would have been considerably earlier. A job that Paul Tillich had. All right. So it isn't very, very long, and Bonhoeffer says, I must go back. And he does. He is aware that returning to Germany will probably mean a deeper involvement in the resistance movement. Bonhoeffer's participation in the resistance movement, I should clarify a distinction. The confessing church, the church struggle, is one thing. The resistance movement, when I talk about that, is another. I'm referring there to a combination of military officials, mostly generals, and some politicians who joined together in the military political conspiracy. Its relationship to the church struggle is only at the point of some overlapping membership in the persons of people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Alfred Delp and Eugene Gerstenmaier and other clerics who happen to be in both. But they're essentially, there's two different movements. Bonhoeffer's own family at this time, and the war has not begun, but the concentration camps have been built for some time. In fact, they were built first of all for Germans, not simply Jews, but communists. And Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, Hans von der Gnani, has moved from the Department of Justice to become the second person to become the right-hand man of the person who's in charge of army counterintelligence. So, in this position, Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law knows what's going on in the concentration camps and knows also the plans for invasion of Poland, etc., etc. And the Bonhoeffer family becomes more deeply involved in the resistance. When Dietrich decides to return in the summer of 1939, home, he anticipates an involvement himself in the resistance movement. He does not know what it is. Now, let me read to you something that Bonhoeffer wrote on the boat on the way back. He came over, incidentally, with his brother, the atomic physicist who went to the University of Chicago. And now he's going back. This is now a section. This essay that he wrote on the way back is a section in the book Ethics, and it's called The Acceptance of Guilt. Listen just to this paragraph. Jesus took upon himself the guilt of all men, and for that reason, every man who acts responsibly becomes guilty. If any man tries to escape guilt in responsible action, think now of the resistance movement, he detaches himself from the ultimate reality of human existence. He sets his own personal innocence above his responsibility for men, and he is blind to the irredeemable guilt which he incurs precisely in this, namely setting his own personal innocence above guilt-incurring action. He is blind also to the fact that real innocence shows itself precisely in a man's entering into the fellowship of guilt for the sake of other men. What Bonhoeffer has in mind there is the fact that the resistance movement would inevitably entail all kinds of, for Bonhoeffer, guilt-incurring actions, deceitful actions even, and there have already been actions to overthrow Hitler. That isn't generally known, but before the war started in 1938, there was an attempt to overthrow Hitler, which then failed. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's father was to be the person who, when Hitler was arrested in that overthrow, examined Hitler as the prominent psychiatrist in Germany to conclude that this man is not capable of running a nation. Well, and anyway, Bonhoeffer knows this. He knows that they will become, by all usual ethical standards, involved in activities in the resistance which are guilty. Guilt incurring. Bonhoeffer now sees his own efforts to leave and his own temptation to stay away from Germany as setting his own personal innocence above responsible actions. And he says in this thing that Jesus as the man for others takes upon himself guilt, and that Christians must do the same. All right. He goes back. He returns to work for a while as the director of the underground seminary for the Confessing Church at Finkenwalde. That doesn't last long because in 1940 the Gestapo came and shut it down. Bonhoeffer tried to carry on that work of training pastors for the Confessing Church on an itinerant basis. A group of seminarians would reside in this village, and then a few more over there, and would do their training and their kind of internship on that basis. There wasn't any single place for the seminary because it had been found out and closed down. All right. So Bonhoeffer carries that on. At the same time, he is approached by his family to undertake some travels in the resistance movement on behalf of the resistance movement. He is asked, because he knows people in the ecumenical movement, to travel abroad to Switzerland and to Sweden to make contact with the Allies, United States, Britain, France, by way of intermediaries. In Sweden, it's by way of Bishop Bell, who is an English bishop in the House of Lords and has direct contact with Anthony Eden. And in Geneva, it's by way of Visser Tuft, who is active in the ecumenical movement, who has international contact. What Bonhoeffer is asked to do is to inform these people of the nature and the existence of the resistance movement and ask the Allied government not to invade Germany. I'll put it this way. Ask the Allied governments to simply halt war operations against Germany at the time of any strike on the part of the resistance movement against the state. There are lots of reasons for that. But that's the nature of Bonhoeffer's task in the resistance movement. These assignments don't come often. In the meantime, he's doing his reading and writing, and the result is a series of essays which never got put together as a single piece, or never finished as a single piece by Bonhoeffer, a series of essays which are now this book, Bonhoeffer's Major Writing Ethics. I find it intriguing that that's what he chose to write at this time. The whole experience for one who was so outspoken and public in his opposition to Nazism in the Confessing Church in the 30s, the whole experience of the resistance movement, which has to be this parading as a Nazi for Bonhoeffer, is one which sets up considerable turmoil for him. Remember now that he was a pacifist conviction earlier on, and now is a part of a resistance movement that is coming more and more to the conclusion that there probably will not be a bloodless overthrow if it is to be successful. They're coming more and more to the conclusion that they probably will have to do away with Hitler by violent means. That whole experience of entering the resistance is rather graphically caught in a number of the writings of Bonhoeffer. As a Christmas present to fellow members of the conspiracy, he wrote an essay in 1943, entitled After 10 Years. The 10 years refers to 10 years of resistance against Hitler. Hitler came to power in 33. Let me just read you one paragraph from that Christmas present essay, the last paragraph. And remember now that to whom he's writing. It's entitled, Are We Still of Any Use? We have been silent witnesses of evil deeds. We have been drenched by many storms. We have learned the arts of equivocation and pretense. Experience has made us suspicious of others and kept us from being truthful and open. Intolerable conflicts have worn us down and even made us cynical. are we still of any use? What we shall not need, what we shall need is not geniuses or cynics or misanthropes or clever tacticians, but plain, honest, straightforward men. Will our inward power of resistance be strong enough and our honesty with ourselves remorseless enough for us to find our way back to simplicity and straightforwardness? And another piece which reflects the kind of turmoil that's going on in Bonhoeffer's life at this time is, not so much turmoil here, but, well, something of what it was to be in the middle of the resistance for one of Bonhoeffer's times. This is in Ethics, in a beautiful section of the book, Ethics as Formation. Today, there are once more villains and saints, and they are not hidden from the public view. Instead of the uniform grayness of the rainy day, we now have the black storm cloud and the brilliant lightning flash. The outlines stand out with exaggerated sharpness. Reality lays itself bare. Shakespeare's characters walk in our midst. But the villain and the saint have little or nothing to do with systematic ethical studies. They emerge from primeval depths, and by their appearance they tear open the infernal or the divine abyss from which they come and enable us to see for a moment into mysteries of which we had never dreamed. Listen to this. What is worse than doing evil, think now of the resistance fighters, doing evil in Bonhoeffer's mind. What is worse than doing evil is being evil. It is worse for a liar to tell the truth than for a lover of truth to lie. All kinds of Nazis, and even Hitler at times, were for Bonhoeffer liars telling the truth about lots of things. And there were lovers of truth whom he met in the resistance who were lying. It is worse for a liar to tell the truth than a lover of truth to lie. It is worse when a misanthropist practices brotherly love than when a philanthropist gives way to hatred. Better than truth in the mouth of the liar is the lie. Better than the act of brotherly love on the part of the misanthrope is hatred. One sin, then, is not like another. They do not all have the same weight. There are heavier sins and lighter sins. A falling away is of infinitely greater weight than a falling down. The most shining virtues of him who has fallen away are as black as night in comparison with the darkest lapses of the steadfast. And then one more, which I think I'm going to say something after this, which sounds kind of contradictory to all of this. When you see here in this poem that Bonhoeffer wrote in prison now, something of the turmoil that's going on in the resistance movement, because again, the resistance movement was made up primarily not of rogues anxious to replace Hitler in order to accrue the same power unto themselves, but primarily of a kind of aristocratic strain that we saw in Nazism and utter barbarization of Germany's heritage and a threat to the world. Okay, the poem is this, Guilt. I hear a trembling and quaking, a murmur, a lamentation outbreaking, hear anger within men's spirits rending, and myriad voices mazily blending, a dumb choir assails God's ear. We, he's talking about the resistance now, hunted by men and abused, made defenseless and then accused, unbearably burdened and losers of all, we are yet the accusers. We accuse all those who forced us to sinning, who let us share in their guilty winning, remember he has parade as a Nazi, into witnessing of injustice surprises us, then as partners in guilt despises. Our eyes upon outrage had to gaze, until we were lost in guilt's dark maze. Then they locked our mouths up fast, dumb as dogs we became at last. That's a prison experience. We too had learned to lie before long, and adapted ourselves to public wrong, and when the defenseless were felled by force, we took it all as a matter of course. And what within our hearts still flamed remained unspoken and unnamed. We checked our blood's insurgent flow and trampled out the inward glow. What sacredly had united men was torn to tatters again and again. Friendship and loyalty were betrayed of tears and regrets a jest was made. We, sons of many a sacred name in the annals of justice and truth, became despisers of God and of men as well, and all around us was the laughter of hell. But now, with both freedom and honor denied before men, we can hold up our heads in pride. And if we are brought into evil fame, we ourselves before men can clear our name. Man against man, our ground we choose, and we, the accused, will in turn accuse. Before thee only, all beings, beginner, thee only is each one of us a sinner. With pain avoided, with deeds denied, we have betrayed thee before mankind. We saw the lie, capital L, in a reference to Hitler and Nazism, we saw the lie uplift its head, but did not honor truth instead. By brothers oppressed, we were greatly needed, but danger of death was all that we needed. As men, we come before thee to pardon our sins, we implore thee. Lord, after these days of fermentation, grant us days of confirmation. After so much going astray, let us see the break of day. Let us, far as eyes can see, build ourselves a road to thee, till our guilt through thee shall cease. Keep us patiently at peace. We in silence still prepare, till thou call to days more fair, till storm and flood thou still, working wonders through thy will. Brother, till the night shall flee, pray for me. There's another poem which I, to my knowledge, has not been translated yet, entitled Moses, in which Bonhoeffer, obviously identifying himself with Moses, not because he thinks he has that place in history, but in the sense of looking through a time, a promised land, seeing a promised land that he shall not enter himself. And there's a line which goes in there, God, I have loved this people, meaning the Germans. God, I am sinking, hold my staff, or something very, very, very close to that. Incidentally, and just simply as an aside, it would be an interesting study sometime to compare both the life and the theology of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King. Even that point, a kind of picture of Moses, of seeing the promised land, of feeling that they probably will not enter it. The night before Martin Luther King was assassinated, you might remember the sermon that he preached, and in which that was precisely the image. All right, now I want to say, even after saying something of the turbulence in Bonhoeffer's life and in the resistance movement, that reading you only these sections can be very misleading, because there's a certain sort of sovereignty over the situation which characterized Bonhoeffer's life and thought, and it's really quite astounding. So that he was fully engaged in the resistance movement, and at the same time, if you read his works at this time, there's a distance from that sufficient enough that he carries on his life as a theologian, as a scholar, as a teacher, without that other business of Germany's fate completely preoccupying him. And so you get great sections in the book Ethics for which there's no trace of what is happening in Germany. And it represents, as I said, a kind of sovereignty of Bonhoeffer over the situation. I visited with friends of Bonhoeffer who were in prison with him, and heard this same kind of thing attested to again and again. His writing in prison, some poetry, some novels, a lot of theological scholarship, but just his conversation with the other prisoners were such that the impression uniformly was of a person who was both able to be passionately engaged in the immediate events around him, and at the same time have a certain distance from them that allowed him to do all kinds of other things. So that when you read letters and papers from prison, you might read a letter that you wouldn't dream was coming from anyone who was experiencing the kind of shock of imprisonment. It may be a long excursus about a line from a Beethoven or something of that sort, or about a particular concert that he listened to on the prison radio that has really taken him, or a work of literature that really has nothing to do with the situation in which he finds himself in. All right. In 1943, in April, Bonhoeffer was arrested along with his brother and his brother-in-law on suspicion of some irregularities in Abwehr, no suspicion of a plot against the state, although some suspicion about being involved in getting papers for Jews, such as to get them out of the country, and Bonhoeffer was involved in that. They were right. He was a part of a group called Operation 7, which smuggled Jews to Switzerland by getting access to German passports and proper clearance. But that means that when Bonhoeffer is in prison, and for the largest share of the letters in Letters and Papers from Prison, Bonhoeffer is optimistic about release. He does really not think that he's going to be there very long, and so the letters and papers are characteristic of that kind of optimism about being released. Now, he starts his theological work again, and he comes to what are for him rather momentous insights that represent basic changes in his thought, although the core of his thought, namely his Christology, his understanding of Jesus, continues from early on till the end. And I'm not going to take time now to go through some of those. We talked, those of you who were here a couple days ago, about some of those ideas, world, come of age, religion, and such. But he becomes intensely involved again in his work, at the same time, his theological work. At the same time, there is an effort to continue the work of the resistance, but at this point it's primarily a sort of holding action. They have to get the same story straight among the resistance figures, because Bonhoeffer and others now are being asked questions which could lead to discovery of their involvement. And they get the same story straight. His brother and his brother-in-law are in different prisons. They get the same story straight because he's also become engaged in the meantime. Most of that engagement period was spent in prison. Courtship wasn't very long. And his fiance and his sisters and his occasionally his parents, who are not well at this point, come to visit him, can do so again. All these contacts, because they move in these upper bourgeois circles, the person who's in charge of an important part of the prison happens to be a cousin of one of the Bonhoeffers and is in the resistance movement. You got to remember that a lot of these folks are right in the middle of things. And so Bonhoeffer has all sorts of privileges and information that come by way of those kind of contacts. So he gets easy chances to visit. And the resistance effort goes on by way of bringing books to Bonhoeffer, which he's going to study anyway. And starting from the back of the book, Bonhoeffer looks for a dot under a letter on every tenth page. And then he puts those letters together to get the sentence and the message. And then when he sends the book out, he replies the same way. You'll find the letters and papers from prison, I think, to be delightful and moving reading, both in their warmth, again, in the kind of sovereignty that Bonhoeffer has over the situation, a wide range of interests and cultivation of a continuous range of moral and aesthetic sensibilities. You'll find the letters and papers from prison, I think, to be delightful and moving reading, both in their warmth, again, in the sense of sovereignty that Bonhoeffer has over the situation, a wide range of interests and cultivation of a continuous range of moral and aesthetic sensibilities, and then some of the exciting theological letters. In the course of the imprisonment in Tegel, however, the resistance movement goes on, and on July 20, 1944, Count von Stauffenberg, who's also is a part of the circle in Army Intelligence, plants the bomb that then, as you perhaps know, is in a briefcase that bothered someone who was sitting across from him. The briefcase is taken out and put in on the other side of the leg of a massive oak table, and it's a solid leg. And the change of position, plus the fact that the meeting with Hitler was moved from a concrete bunker to a wooden barracks, probably explains the fact that when the explosion occurred, those two factors kept Hitler alive. Anyway, the consequence of that is that there's a tremendous, of course, inquiry into the resistance, and all sorts of people are arrested. And after July 20, 1944, Bonhoeffer knows that he must reckon with his own death. In fact, it is only on July 21, then, the day after, that he writes the poem Stations on the Road to Freedom, and the last stanza of the poem is entitled Death. Come now, thou greatest of feasts, on the journey to freedom eternal, Death. Cast aside all the burdensome chains and demolish the walls of our temporal body, the walls of our souls that are blinded, so that at last we may see that which here remains hidden. Freedom. How long we have sought thee in discipline, action, and suffering. Dying, we now may behold thee revealed in the Lord. So Bonhoeffer from July 20 has to reckon with his own death. And again, I think the astounding thing is the kind of work that he continues to do in keeping with his whole life, even after that point. Okay, then after that point, there are more hearings, and through whatever means, the role of Bonhoeffer, which it should not be exaggerated, it's not a central role in the resistance. Other people play a far more important role, including other members of his own family. But his participation is found out. He is transferred to the Gestapo, from the military prison to the Gestapo prison, and there he continues to work on this new book that he's so excited about Christianity and a world come of age. And he is then transferred to several different concentration camps for short stays. And in April of 1945, only 3 days before the Americans liberated that particular concentration camp, he was along with not members of his family, but other but friends in that same circle of resistance, was hanged. I think the sort of the hardest note in the whole story is that because of the chaos in Germany at that time, his parents learned of the death of Dietrich Bonhoeffer one night when, as was characteristic of the family, in order to keep in contact with the outside world, were listening to the BBC and heard a memorial service for Dietrich Bonhoeffer being broadcast from London. This is at the same time that they learn of the death of Klaus, his older brother, Dietrich's older brother, of Hans von der Gnani, son-in-law, and of Rüdiger Schleicher, another son-in-law. So there are four of the men in the family who died at the same time. But the parents, also involved, continued to live on for a while. And I think Karl Bonhoeffer died not too long thereafter, about 1948. I don't know about his wife. There are some beautiful letters, and I'm sorry that I didn't bring sufficient books along. There's a beautiful letter by the parents about the place of the kids that the old man wrote shortly before he himself died. Let me, closing my part, and so that I don't completely monopolize this, just read a final passage from the book Ethics. It'll sound perhaps somewhat anticlimactic, but I think that it, in a way, sums up the thrust of Bonhoeffer's theology, and Bonhoeffer, in the end, thought theologically, and his action was very much an outcome of his theology, which was, in turn, a reflection upon his self-reflection on the faith for him. But this represents both an account of his own way of seeing things and an account of what has become one of the enduring gifts of Bonhoeffer to Protestants and now also Catholic theology, the relationship of God, Jesus, ourselves, and the world. In Christ, we are offered the possibility of partaking in the reality of God and in the reality of the world, but not in the one without the other. The reality of God discloses itself only by setting me entirely in the reality of the world. And when I encounter the reality of the world, it is always already sustained, accepted, and reconciled in the reality of God. This is the inner meaning of the revelation of God in the man Jesus Christ. Christian ethics inquires about the realization in our world of this divine and cosmic reality which is given in Christ. This does not mean that our world is something outside the divine and cosmic reality which is in Christ, or that it is not already part of the world which is sustained, accepted, and reconciled in him. It does not mean that one must still begin by applying some kind of principle to our situation and our time to determine Christian behavior. The inquiry is directed rather towards the way in which the reality in Christ, which for a long time already has comprised us and our world within itself, is taking effect as something now present, and towards the way in which life may be conducted in this reality. Its purpose is, therefore, participation in the reality of God of the world in Jesus Christ today. And this participation must be such that I never experience the reality of God without the reality of the world, or the reality of the world without the reality of God. Again, for Bonhoeffer, one comes up against God, one meets God, one lives in Christ by plunging, as he says, into the midst of life's perplexities and problems, successes and failures. And it's there, and only there, but it is there, that faith is to be lived. He says at one point, in a letter to his fiancée, that he's always suspicious of people who have one... He doesn't think he'd like to stand like the people who have one foot on earth and one foot in heaven. The Bonhoeffer was a great fan of Nietzsche, as a matter of fact, and one of Nietzsche's heroes is Antaeus, who loses his strength when he does not have his feet planted, both feet planted firmly on the earth. So this is just part of this theme of Bonhoeffer, that you cannot participate in the reality of God without participating fully in the life of the world, and you cannot participate fully in the life of the world without at the same time being caught up in a world that is already sustained, reconciled by God through Jesus Christ. Okay, let me kind of shut up at least for a little while, and you say what you'd like to say. Keith.
There's another poem, I think it's in Letters and Papers, I think that's just super, and it directly talks about the sovereignty you're talking about.
Yeah.
And yet, he comes across, I can identify with him in that more easily than some of his other.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because in contrast to what some other writings where Bonhoeffer is against this kind of introspection on the part of people, who am I is a very introspective thing. Let me see if I can find it, because
I believe it's in the Cost of Discipleship.
Oh, I think you're right, in the beginning. Because the last line in the last verse in there is such a terrific statement of Bonhoeffer's own. It should be, I should be able to grab these things. You're right. Thank you, whoever knew me in Cost of Discipleship. Now, this is written in prison. And Bonhoeffer has been told by many people, as I mentioned before, who were really struck by his kind of, as I said, his sovereignty over the situation, or his composure in that situation. Who am I? They, meaning the people in prison, often tell me, and even though he's a prisoner, he acted very much as a chaplain. Who am I? They often tell me I stepped from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I used to speak of my warders, to my warders, freely and friendly and clearly, as though it were mine to command. Incidentally, it was one of the warders in the prison that became so taken with Bonhoeffer that he himself became an intermediary in getting information from prison to the resistance. Of course, that was, and it would have been found out, that was punishable by death, and arranged one time for an escape from prison by Bonhoeffer. And then a turn of events in the resistance movement made Bonhoeffer conclude, who was planning on this, conclude that it was not the right time to leave because his absence might jeopardize the lives of others. Okay. Who am I? They also tell me I bore the days of misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I then really that which other men tell of? Or am I only that, only what I myself know of myself? Restless and longing and sick like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, of neighborliness, tossing in expectation of great events. That line is written with the strike on Hitler's life in mind, July 20. Tossing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, Stauffenberg. Weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint, and ready to say farewell to it all. Bonhoeffer seriously contemplated suicide. Who am I, this or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once, a hypocrite before others and before myself, a contemptible, woebegone weakling? Or is something within me still like a beaten army fleeing in disorder from victory already achieved? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. That last line is the line which is the anti-introspection of Bonhoeffer, in the sense that he thinks it does not, in the end, avail for us to contemplate who we are and to make the search for self our own chief search. Now, you can say lots of things about that, but I'm just saying that Bonhoeffer's own thrust is to, in the end, to say, I can't answer those questions, who am I? But whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I'm thine. And that, of course, is the kind of answer.
Did Bonhoeffer know while he was in the prison and before he was hanged how the war was going?
He was confident that Germany was going to be defeated. And in fact, he walked into Visitor's office in Geneva at one time, and this was at the time of the march on Stalingrad. And when was that? 42? So long before the end of the war. And he walked into Visitor's office and said, "It's all over." I mean, he thought that the march into Russia, in fact, he thought that the fighting the war on both fronts meant that Germany was defeated. And you can imagine something of the, that also occasioned some turmoil, in the sense that he found himself as a patriotic German, and that's really what that summer decision in 39 meant, that he was a patriot. The decision to go back. As a patriotic German, having, as he said, to pray for the defeat of his own nation. This is part of the turbulence of the resistance movement and part of its ineffectiveness. It was not an effective resistance movement in many respects. But part of the turbulence is the fact that these were patriotic Germans. If you were a resistor against Nazism in Holland, or in Norway, or somewhere else, you were a hero. And you had the support of the people, had all kinds of help. You were a resistor and Hitler, you could not trust your friends. And, I mean, that was... Yeah.
I have a question that kind of reflects back to the first thing we were talking about, and I don't remember exactly where you were, but you're talking about something about that men operating in the world were responsible for what they did on human terms, the good and the bad, and that the religious went to God in the bad or the
times of failure and distress, yes.
And I wonder that day, and I still do, where God did fit into all that with him, because it seemed like he was saying man is responsible for everything. Yet he's so, you know, his life is so full of intense Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
mm-hmm.
And now when you said that you can't experience the reality of the world without the reality of God, it seems like everything is fitting together. But I'm kind of confused.
Mm-hmm.
On that.
Mm-hmm.
And where does God fit in for him? I mean, does he give God credit for? For our minds, or for what man does, then, or
yes. From Letters and Papers, here's the decisive difference between Christianity and other religions. I'm not sure that Bonhoeffer is right about that, but let's take him at face value here. Man's religiosity makes him look at, in his distress, to the power of God in the world. God is the Deus Ex Machina, the God who intervenes in order to set right what we fouled up. The Bible directs man to God's powerlessness and suffering. Only the suffering God can help. To that extent, we may say that the development toward the world's coming of age outlined above, which is done away with a false conception of God, opens up a way of seeing the God of the Bible, who wins power and space in the world by his weakness. This will probably be the starting point of our non-religious interpretation.
By
the fact that God is in the midst of the suffering and is the suffering weak God who is crucified. Now, that doesn't answer your question, except to say that Bonhoeffer, first of all, certainly does see God's activity in the world and Christ's activity in the world as mediated through humans. Agency. You can call, and you might call that our being co-creators, is sometimes a phrase that might be used. So that Bonhoeffer only understands Christ to be present in and in with and under, a Lutheran term, the neighbor. So humans are the agency of God. Now there's other agency too, a nature. And so on. What else?
Does he recognize God at all as being the God of power, as we've seen, and a God that we can go to? If we are, you know, I understand.
It's the suffering God is the one that one goes to, who wins power and strength through that suffering. But another question asked, there is a notion of transcendence of God in Bonhoeffer, that somehow he's more than, God is more than the sum total of human endeavors. And at that point, Bonhoeffer wants also to locate transcendence in God's being for Jesus, the man for others, being for others. Now, this is difficult stuff, and I don't make pretension to be able to fully explicate it, but let me just read from the outline for the new book. Who is God? Not, in the first place, an abstract belief in God, in God's omnipotence, omniscience, etc. This is not a genuine experience of God, but a partial extension of the world. Encounter with Jesus Christ, this is all scribbled notes, these aren't complete sentences. The experience that a transformation of all human life is given in the fact that Jesus is there only for others. His being there for others is the experience of transcendence. It is only this being there for others, maintained until death, that is the ground of any talk of omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. It is only in that being for others, and in Bonhoeffer locates God's the sort of special place in the suffering being for others, that one senses the dimensions of God. Then you might talk about his omnipresence, being felt that one is in the midst of an all-encompassing presence, and maybe even a kind of final good. Faith is participation in this being of Jesus, incarnation, cross, and resurrection. Our relation to God is not a religious relationship to the highest, most powerful, and best being imaginable. That is not authentic transcendence. But our relation to God is a new life in existence for others through participation in the being of Jesus. The transcendental is not infinite and unattainable tasks. The transcendental is the neighbor who is within reach in any given situation. God in human form, as the man, not as the man in himself, but the man for others, and therefore the crucified, the man who lives out of the transcendent.
I recall from somewhere, I think it's from the Letters and Papers, where he tells about he was in prison, and prison was being bombed.
Yeah.
And he found himself on his knees, pray,
yeah,
just as a child would pray in,
yeah,
a situation of fear.
Yeah.
And he said that he, if I recall correctly, you apparently know this passage, that he didn't know quite how to integrate that,
yeah,
with his ideas, you know, because that is what I hear Ann talking about. You know, the man on his knees praying to God, you know, no other people around him.
No question that Bonhoeffer experiences fear, anxiety, and turns to God in those times and situations of distress, weakness, at the end of his tether. No question about that. I don't think he would even object. I don't think he objects to that, unless that is religious rather than non-religious. In his words, of religious. In other words, unless that only is a turning to God as a consequence of not wanting to struggle through that oneself with all of one's being, so that God becomes the crutch. Now, beyond that, I think it needs to be said that Bonhoeffer's talk of world cultivation, religious, and these kind of things is the writing of one who is excited about what he finds and experiences as new insights. That tends to set up in all of us a kind of polemic. So we make either or kinds of choices. We say, aha, it's this, not that. And that not is religion for Bonhoeffer. I sometimes wonder if he wouldn't have, after some time, made some sort of qualifications which would have maintained the turning to the fact that he wants us to find God in what we do know, in our strength, in our achievements, in what we do well, as well as finding God in our weaknesses, where he says, whereas he says, and not in our weaknesses, etc. I think that's part of a kind of discovery mentality.
Well, apart from suffering, and like how we view God as creator, does he accepts all that?
Yeah. And he even sees that in Christological terms. That's part of what I said. He has what's called a cosmic Christology, where the incarnation means that all of nature is taken up, is indicative of the presence there of God. Some beautiful passages of that kind. In fact, there's a kind of, as with most Germans, I think, it's almost sort of nature mysticism in Bonhoeffer. And I had to chuckle at the time that that Harvey Cox, for whom I have great respect, wrote The Secular City and in praise of the city and used Bonhoeffer through and through for some sort of theological authority for that. Because there are sections in Paper in Prison where Bonhoeffer says, I would much rather live in the country than in the city any old day. And they go on these long walks, sort of being mystical all over the place about nature. But there isn't any disjunction in Bonhoeffer of God as creator and God as redeemer. It's the redemption of creation.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm up here.
Uh-huh.
I gathered from listening that Bonhoeffer probably didn't have too much of eschatology and didn't speak much of hope for a kingdom to come. And am I right in assuming that he thought perhaps most hope for that coming kingdom was an escape and using God as a in a religious sense?
No, that question is a tough one, Tom, about Bonhoeffer's eschatology. But one should not, in any case, it's clear that Bonhoeffer has a very strong sense of Christian hope. It is grounded in the resurrection, which has already occurred. That's the foretaste of things to come. And Bonhoeffer is very, very clear about that sort of ultimate triumph that the resurrection signals. The theologians are often critical, however, for a sort of underdevelopment of eschatology in Bonhoeffer. I think it probably theologically comes out of the fact that Bonhoeffer's Christology is so heavily an incarnational Christology, and most incarnational Christologies have had a tendency anyway not to develop eschatology. That's a sort of technical debate, but I just would want to say in reply to you that one would clearly have to say that what really impels Bonhoeffer, sustains him at times, is a strong sense of Christian hope. He talks about a fresh wind blowing from the resurrection. That's why he says the world, even no matter what kind of condition it's in, And think about what he's living under. Then no matter what kind of condition in, it's already sustained and redeemed in Jesus Christ because of the cross and resurrection.